8 a.m. having arrived and actually a little bit past, I'm going to call to order the Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. First bill on the agenda, I believe, is House File 3357, Representative Marquardt.
Yeah.
Representative Marquardt, I believe this bill goes to the General Registry.
Yes, correct.
So I will move that House File 3357 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Registry. Representative Marquardt, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill that is a consensus bill that came out of the work of the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Task Force. And it's been meeting since November. It's had senators on it, representatives on it, members of the township, representatives, members from cities and so forth. And this is a bill that has taken some of the low-hanging fruit, but also does make some changes that are agreed upon by both. I have here, in local government, we gave a very thorough description of things, and I don't know how much you want to go into, Mr. Chair, but I do have here the Honorable Judge Bruce Johnson, who is the Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge, who has worked with municipal adjustments for a number of years now, and he's going to give a little summary of the work of the task force.
And welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Bruce Johnson. I'm Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings, and I'm also Chair of the Legislative Advisory Task Force on Municipal Boundary Adjustment. As Representative Marquardt indicated, there are 11 members of this task force, and this bill, the contents of this bill, had complete consensus among the 11 members. It is primarily technical in nature, although there are some technical changes that
Mr. Johnson, I believe the only areas that this committee is interested in would be Article 1 and then Article 1, Section 21. We don't have in our committee jurisdiction the entire bill, but just
right.
Those sections.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, in essence, just a little bit of background, prior to 1999, these functions were conducted by the Municipal Board, and that year the board was sunsetted and the functions were transferred to the Office of Strategic and Long-Term Planning. In, I believe, 2003, by executive reorganization order, those functions were transferred to the Department of Administration and then in March of 2005 to our office. And in effect, there are two sections of the bill. The first section of the bill basically catches up with where the functions are. In other words, transfers the functions from the director to the Chief Administrative Law Judge. The second section of the bill makes conforming changes in legislation other than Chapter 414. That essentially, I believe, the transfer of functions is what this committee is concerned about, is it not? Mr. Chair?
No, I'm sorry. I thought we had a question.
No, I'm assuming that's the primary concern of this committee is the transfer of new functions to our office.
All right. Any questions from the committee?
No. Yeah. And then also it extends, the other thing is it extends the life of the task force until actually there was an amendment in the local government committee to January 15th. 2008, we were able to get a lot of work done on this bill, but there's an expectation we can do better if we keep working, and I think the leadership in both bodies wanted us to keep working. So that's in a nutshell, I think.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify for or against the bill? And seeing no questions, I'll renew my motion that House File 3357 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Next bill on the agenda, Representative Latrimba, and I'm looking for her. I don't see her. And then Representative Kalin. time. Representative Kalin isn't here, which brings us down to House File 3367. House File 3367, I believe we have an amendment. And is Ms. Niren here? I saw her just a bit ago.
She's up in the hall, Mr. Chair.
All right. See here? It would appear that almost no one is here. Apparently, people aren't used to starting on time.
And they say you won't hear anybody's bill.
All right. Representative Scalzi, we're going to drop down to yours. House File 3135.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members
Representative we're unsure as to this bill would have to go to finance. Is that correct? Does this have a fiscal note?
It will, yes.
All right. Then I will move that House File 3135 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. Representative Scalzi, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate you hearing my bill. In the last couple of months, I was a member of a working group called Government Accountability and Reform Institute, and we worked on a number of issues where we felt that state government could be more accountable to the taxpayers and to local governments as well. And as a part of that initiative, one of the bills that we worked on was making sure that the state government didn't pass costs on to the local governments without having a local impact note accompanying those bills. So what we came up with was, and I should back up a little bit, because there is currently in law the requirement that a local impact note could be requested by the chairs of either tax committee of the House or the Senate, or of the ranking either the chairs or the ranking minority member of those committees. And what we are doing with this bill is expanding that slightly to first of all, I should back up and say I'd like to have this amendment attached.
I think I've got the amendment. It's the 808-1336 amendment. Is that correct?
And I would like to have that passed.
All right. I will move the 808-1336 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to the bill as amended.
So you can look at your amendment. It's a delete all amendment. And there's just two lines in this bill. It would change the request of the chair, the ranking minority member of the tax committee, and it would expand it to include any legislative committee with jurisdiction over the proposed legislation. So in other words, if it were a environment committee or public safety committee, they could as well request a local impact note. It would just expand it a little bit so that we could make sure that we understand how local governments pay the bills. The way local impact notes work is that the finance department contacts by email about 50 different local government units, and they ask them to, by return email, tell them what they thought it would cost them to make this law work in their city. And then the finance department prepares a report from that. So I would like your approval on this bill. I have Jen O'Rourke here from the League of Minnesota Cities if you have any questions.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities, and we just want to be here to support the bill that Representative Scalzi brought before you.
All right. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to put on the record, Representative Scalzi, this is an excellent idea, and I thank you for bringing it forward. I strongly support it.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Anyone wish to testify? Seeing none, then I'll renew my motion that House File 3135, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I thought I saw Representative Hornstein is up there. Representative Hornstein, why don't you come down? And Representative Hornstein, I will move that House File 3725 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. Representative Hornstein, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3725 is relating to a transportation issue, so I'm glad that the Government Operations Committee will have a chance to take a look at initiative on transportation. I'm going to give a very brief background, and then I'm going to hand it over to Bernie Arsenault from MnDOT, who will explain a little bit more detail about this process. The reason it's before you is that there's a rulemaking exemption issue. That's why it's before our GovOps and Subdivision 4, page 2. But let me first give you a little background about the Urban Partnership Agreement. Members, this is a federal grant that was awarded to our region from the federal U.S. DOT. Only five cities in the country regions were awarded this grant in a very competitive process. It's an innovative program that combines expansion of transit, which is my interest, with tolling, technology, and telecommunications. The four T's are involved in this. This is a corridor from downtown Minneapolis to Lakeville, which I've been working on a bipartisan way with our colleagues in the South Metro for about 4 years to promote, again, expanded bus transit in this corridor. There's many advantages to that. I don't want to get into that too intensively, other than to say that this process can be completed by the end of 2009. We're here at the legislature in order to match the $133 million federal grant. It's an 80-20 match, so we have to come up with a small amount of matching money here. Some of that money is was passed in the Transportation Finance Bill. There's also some allocations in the bonding bill. This is a policy change that also has to allow for this grant to take place. So it's the UPA policy bill that is before us today. So I'm going to now call on Mr. Arsenault, who I believe has distributed some handouts, and then he can go over a few other fine points of the bill. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And
Representative Hornstein, I have two amendments here.
Okay.
A5 and A1.
Okay.
And which do you want to have moved first, the A5 or the A1?
Okay. Let me get those from the page in just a second. I think that we'll move the A1 first.
Mr. Chair? Some of us have two A5s and no A1.
All right, then that probably won't work. So we need everyone to have the A1 and the A5.
I just need to look at these, because, Mr. Chair, because it may be more appropriate to add these in the Transportation Committee, but you know, if it can be done here, we can do that here. But I want to really stick to the purview of the committee. And
all right.
So I'll take a look at those. I didn't anticipate that happening, but maybe we could have Mr. Arsenault's presentation.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bernie Arsenault. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I've been working on this Urban Partnership Agreement project. You've got two handouts are being distributed. One that is a map, looks like this, with the 35W corridor on it all the way down, and both sheets. And that shows a little more detail of each of the projects that are part of this innovative project. And the second sheet two sheets are just a summary of the Urban Partnership Agreement and the impact, and that might be a better one to work off of for a quick summary. this project started, or at least the proposal from the federal government came out a year ago last fall. Minnesota was one of about 30 different urban areas to submit a proposal for the Urban Partnership Agreement. Ultimately, we were shortlisted to a group of nine, and finally successful in being one of the grant recipients of the Urban Partnership Agreement. This essentially creates a MinPass hot lane, or high occupancy toll lane, from south in the Burnsville area all the way to Minneapolis. It's similar to the MinPass lane that many of you are familiar with on 394. It is a congestion pricing program where we provide a priced lane from the south all the way to Minneapolis that enables you to have a guaranteed or a 95% guaranteed trip of 50 miles an hour or more throughout that whole corridor. It'll go through the 494 interchange, through the new Crosstown project, and right up into Minneapolis. Probably the centerpiece of our proposal and one of the main reasons that we were selected is on the north end, north of about 46th Avenue or 46th Street, we have got, we're utilizing the shoulder real estate of the highway to become a lane during congested periods. Now this will always stay on the left side. This will be a left side hot lane from Burnsville all the way up to Minneapolis. But in the very northern section, and on the second sheet that shows the different colors, the red, blue, and green, it's the green section that is the what we're calling the price dynamic shoulder lane section, where during peak periods we'll open up the shoulder with the use of some ITS or intelligent transportation system technology to safely utilize that shoulder area in moving traffic through the corridor. We are using a great deal of intelligent transportation systems and freeway management systems along this corridor. There will be multiple, about every half mile, we'll have lane control signals that will enable us to deal with incidents and to provide additional information to the user so that we can ensure the safest and most reliable trip through the corridor. At this point, I think I would just offer... open up to any questions.
Representative Hornstein, I think the only part of the bill that we're really interested in is Section 1, Subdivision 4, page 2, lines 25 through 27.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, that's why I feel like these amendments really ought to be discussed in the Transportation Committee.
That's fine. So if we could, members, confine our questions to that portion of the bill, if anyone has any questions. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Bernie, what was your last name?
Arsenal.
Thank you, Mr. Arsenal.
Yeah,
I was made aware of this program last year when my community came to me and was frustrated because MnDOT had been going ahead with plans for this and they were not following the guidelines for contacting the community and getting approval from the community. For this plan that's before us today, has MnDOT made the effort and contacted all of the communities that this corridor would run through and received approval from those cities?
Mr. Arsenal.
Mr. Chair and members, initially this was a very aggressive time frame. I mentioned it was in late fall, maybe December of 06, that this came about, and we had to have our submittal in by April 15th or 30th of that year. And so we did move quickly. We did bring together a group of stakeholders, the Solutions Alliance, among others, that we brought in to get input, but it did move on a very fast track. And since that time, we've been able to kind of regroup, and we've now developed a communications subgroup of our steering team that is developing a outreach proposal that not only deals with constituents and citizens, but it also deals with policymakers and legislative folks. We have had several workshops that we have invited folks throughout the state to learn about this and to become involved if they are interested. So we do recognize that initially, you know, there may have been some misses, but it was because of the aggressive track that we were following in order to deliver this proposal. But we do believe at this point that we have developed a communications plan that will offer a great deal of opportunity for not only citizens but also policymakers to become involved and understand what this project is.
Representative Anderson, you good?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Arsenal, so is it true, so do have the city signed off on this, that this is where this corridor would run through? All the cities said, yes, we are accessible to this.
Mr. Arsenal.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I'm not sure that I can say that we've actually got that approval at this point. I believe that we are continuing to work with them. I'm not aware of any of those communities that are opposed to this project.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much. And I will just speak on, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, on, in terms of Minneapolis, which is a significant part of this. The city of Minneapolis strongly supports this, and my district has this will run through one particularly active neighborhood in my district, Kingfield, and we've had a series of meetings there. The city council has come out, and we've had a public hearing. So I think particularly in these neighborhoods of Minneapolis that are particularly sensitive to projects like this and both their advantages and any concerns that they may have, I think there's been a lot of engagement from that end. And as Mr. Arsenault said, the 35W Solutions Alliance has been engaged from the start, and this is a partnership that includes both municipal and county officials along the corridor.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to add on to what Representative Hornstein was commenting on the 35W Solutions Alliance. I know from south of the river, there are representatives from Dakota County and Scott County and the city of Burnsville who sit on the Solutions Alliance. They're very, very excited about this this opportunity to improve traffic flow along 35W.
Representative Cox.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, why do you need exemptions from rulemaking requirements rather than using expedited rulemaking authority?
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to Mr. Arsenault on that, but I think that implicit in your question is the fact that we have some deadlines to meet for the federal grant, but I'll have Mr. Arsenault.
Mr. Arsenault.
Comment.
Correct, Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn. That's correct. This is an extremely aggressive time frame. We are expected to deliver the lion's share of this proposal by September of 2009. We're in the process right now of developing the plans, and you know, as soon as we, one of the criteria that we need to meet in order to get the federal dollars is to have the authorizing legislation through. We've really crunched this together, and so because of that aggressive schedule and also the fact that we've developed this communications plan and have involved these stakeholders in that process, we believe it's appropriate to ask for these exemptions.
Okay.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, nothing you said has answered my question. How long does expedited rulemaking take, and why does it use expedited rulemaking, which doesn't, I understand why you wouldn't use traditional rulemaking. I have no problems with that. But why wouldn't you use an expedited rulemaking, and what's the length of time that that takes? September doesn't seem to me as if that's, that's too far off. Or too close, whatever.
Mr. Arsenault, you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, the September 2009 is the delivery date of the project, right? And so we need to be doing lightings now. I cannot speak to the length of time that the expedited rulemaking takes. I'm not sure of that.
Chairman, someone on the committee answer that? I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that we have a rulemaking process for is for public information and for public input and so forth. I understand the time crunch, but nothing that was said about the time crunch would mean that you wouldn't use the expedited rulemaking rather than just total exemption from rulemaking. I think we should do that only when it's like absolutely necessary, why we have to do something the next day and so forth. So I, if someone could tell us what that time frame is.
Mr. Shepherd, you want to explain this and then maybe confirm the verbiage that's being used?
Mr. Chair and members, the expedited rulemaking in Section 14.389 would probably take in the neighborhood of 3 to 6 months.
What's the time?
And now that we have the terminology correct, we can rip that answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Arsenault, would this exclusion from the rulemaking process be just for this project, or is it going to be for any other ones that come up?
Mr. Arsenault.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it is exclusively for this project.
Any further discussion? All right. Rips and Hilty?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn pursued the line of questioning that I had intended. I think that's probably close enough.
Thank you, Representative Hilty. Any other discussion? And Representative Hornstein, you do not want the amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, I know that you're someone that has been a great mentor to many of us about proper process, and it just seems to me that these are very kind of technical transportation-related amendments that I think would be more appropriately handled in that committee, and so
that's fine.
In the interest of time and appropriateness, we can lay those over.
And this bill then would be referred to Transportation Finance.
Correct. And I think that would be the next stop for it. Representative Leader.
No, it's going to Finance first, and then it will be referred to.
Correct.
Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 3725 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Otremba, did we see you?
There she is.
Representative Otremba, does this still go to Finance? That's the initial word we have.
I believe so.
All right. Then I will move that House File 2683 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. Representative Otremba.
Basically, this is the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council. We started this in 1997 because there was a shortage of agricultural teachers, and so we are at our ending as 10 years, and so we're coming back to renew the program. I have someone with me if you want a little bit of...
Well, Representative Turnbull, I think we're interested in the expiration date for the council, and you're extending it, is that correct, from 2008 to 2013?
Correct.
So do you want to speak to that? I believe that's what we're interested in. And would you like... Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Kesh, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, which I'll refer to now as NAILSE. Excuse me, we were created in 1997. Originally, we were to sunset in the year 2000. We received a three-year extension at that time, and then in 2003, we came back and received a five-year extension. And so we are back here now requesting a five-year extension. We were created because we had a shortage of agricultural education teachers and actually a shortage for our workforce in agriculture in general. I'm happy to say we have been very successful in recruiting a large number of students to go into agricultural education, but unfortunately with our aging population, we are facing a continued shortage. And so we have a lot of work yet to do. We work highly with high school agricultural education programs, farm management programs. We have 23,000 secondary students, 4,000 farm families we work with. We also help start an agricultural education high school here in the Twin Cities area. So we've been very busy, very active. We have a lot of work that is yet unfinished.
Right. Any questions? No questions. Anyone else wish to testify? All right, then I'll renew my motion that House File 2683 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Turnbull.
Thank you. Thank you, Committee.
Representative Winkler, do you want to do your bill? Why don't we get yours?
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 3770 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. And I do have an oral amendment I'd like to offer.
Representative Winkler, what is your amendment?
Mr. Chair, I would move that on line 3.2, in the middle of that line, there's an ellipse, which I would substitute the date December 1st for the blank space. And likewise, on line 3.25, there's an ellipse where I would put in the date December 1st.
Mr. Shepard, I would prefer these not be referred to as oral amendments, but as amendments, and that they be passed. So Mr. Shepard, do you want to confirm that that amendment works?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe that works as stated by Representative Winkler.
And Ms. Benson, do you have the amendment? Mr. Shepard, repeat the amendment for us. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and I will write this down for Ms. Anderson as well, but on page 3, line 2, delete the ellipse and insert December 1, and on page 3, line 25, delete the ellipse and insert December 1.
Right. And Representative Winkler is going to move that as an amendment, so any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill is, like Representative Scalzi's bill we heard this morning, the product of a series of meetings that we held over the summer and fall with members to develop an accountability agenda for this session. And this bill is a particular interest of Senator Rest. And essentially what it does is require the Office of Educational Technology, Educational Enterprise Technology, not in yesterday's bill, Office of Enterprise Technology to report to the legislature on the total technology requests brought forward by state agencies for that budget year. And just a couple of examples. Right now, before the Public Safety Finance Committee, there is a $50 million request to change out that agency's mainframe computer system and replace it with another mainframe computer system. The Department of Finance has a $30 million finance system replacement project in front of state government finance. The Department of Revenue has a $20 million project in front of the State Government Finance Committee. Last year, Minsky had a $60 million technology request that went through the Higher Ed Committee. These are large and
oh,
several.
$70 million, but who counts?
Close enough, Mr. Chair. 66, I think it was. The idea simply is
they took 70, but that's okay.
Mr. Chair, I had no idea that would be a particular interest of yours.
Some interest.
Mr. Chair, members, all this does basically is require that all those technology requests have to be filtered through as a single report to the legislature rather than being sent out piecemeal so that we can decide what the priorities should be. And this is also part of an ongoing discussion and reporting and study process that OET has been conducting along with the State Government Finance Committee and the relevant committees in the Senate to address how they can best finance technology projects and how we can best measure what the return on the investment to the state of Minnesota will be for them. So this is just part of that process. OET does have an amendment that they will be bringing forward in Senator Rest Committee on Friday, but this will get us, I think, to the point of having this on the House side, and we can negotiate the final details when Senator Rest is ready.
All right. Any further discussion? Nurse Embrun.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Winkler, I'm curious about what OET has in mind related to, you know, when you replace the mainframe in one department and one agency, and then the next agency has their plan, and the next agency has their plan. At what point can the OET actually potentially take advantage of efficiencies and processes, I guess, and put together one big system from which all those agencies can draw out of versus each one of the agencies continuing to purchase something, boxing themselves in and boxing the state into continued expenditures?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, that is part of what OET's mission is. I think part of the challenge that they've had is that, of course, all the agencies
have their own systems and their own turf that they defend. And part of the reason for this legislation is to strengthen the hand of OEP and strengthen the reporting and information gathering ability of that. It's not an agency, but it is a standalone department and or office, I guess, to strengthen their hand in that negotiation. They have several initiatives underway, and the Department of Administration, for example, has put together common purchasing tools for technology, but there is a long, long way to go still to make this actually work for what you're talking about.
Yeah. Representative Khan.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, the final approval of anything is 16E.03 subdivision 3, which says that a state agency may not undertake an information and telecommunications technology project until it's been evaluated according to the procedures, and it has to be signed off. That's something which hasn't always been done, and there have been parts of the legislation passed that's tried to get around that, or tried to get around that that approval. It is interesting because we used to have this report that Representative Winkler is now requesting, and that was probably eliminated partially through my actions because I started reading the report and acting on it, and the result was that they eliminated the report in future years so that we wouldn't have this kind of detailed information. But we'll see what happens when we reinstate it and when Representative Winkler will be reading it instead of me.
Mm-hmm. Representative Winkler.
I have no comment, Mr. Chair. I would encourage a yes vote.
Well,
Representative Khan.
My other point is, what's the rest of the amendment that... You shouldn't say tantalizing things like there's an amendment that's going to the Senate that we're not allowed to see. What's the thrust of that amendment?
We don't have the amendment.
I know. I want to know. I'm just asking what the thrust of that amendment. This is a change that supposedly is going to be made to this bill, and if Representative Winkler knows something about it, I'd like to know about it.
Tantalizing as it is, dealing in hypotheticals only makes this session even more complex. Representative Winkler, if you want to start dealing in hypotheticals.
Mr. Chair, I think I can address Representative Khan without doing that. Based on information I have received, it appears that the Office of Enterprise Technology is interested in strengthening this bill and adding additional language which would further support their mission of trying to get all of these requests put together in one kind of package, at least at one point in the legislative session.
Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion? Anyone else wish to testify? Representative Winkler, you want to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 3770 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Winkler. Representative Hartman.
Yes,
Finance. Representative Hartman, I'm going to move that House File 3113 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. So, Representative Hartman, see your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a question. Do you know whether there's a fiscal note, whether this needs to go to the Finance Committee?
Representative Hartman, it was our understanding that Finance Committee wanted to see it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, I think it has to go there.
I think that's the way things work.
It will in this committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The House File 3113 is designed to provide legislators with more detailed budget information from the executive branch so that we can do a better job of exercising our oversight role and our responsibility to eliminate unnecessary expenditures. I think everybody gets this three-ring binder. They get three of them with the governor's entire budget in it. And if you spend time with this document, you come away with very little understanding of the expenditures in the departments and what they're for and where we could cut waste. And we don't see enough detail to be good overseers of what's being spent. a lot of people in the legislature now, in my class, and in the class that came after, came out of the business environment. And when we look at spreadsheets in the business environment, we know how many employees there are in a division, what the mission of the division is, what each of the employees are contributing to the mission of that division. And as we look at the entire entity, we see places where we could be more effective, and we see places that are less effective, things that we could cut. So House File 3113 would ask for more detailed information and would ask for it to come earlier to the legislature. Section 3 is really where the bulk of the change would be, and it requests the information that I just talked about from the executive branch.
Right. Any discussion? Representative Cox.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Portman, is there any change for a year in which the governor changes, the administration changes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Well, Representative Kahn, isn't going to be a historical perspective,
yes,
is it?
Well, it's like a constitutional perspective. Every 4 years, we have an election in the state in which we elect the governor. Every once in a while, that changes, and the administration changes. And a change of administration, which will have occurred in November, it might be very difficult to meet these deadlines. Is there any language in there that reflects that change which might happen every 4 years?
Representative Portman.
No, Mr. Chair, I had not considered that that would be more difficult for a new administration coming, or if not impossible, to meet the deadline that's in the statute. So we could definitely come up with a written amendment for the Finance Committee.
Representative
Kahn. Mr. Chairman, perhaps I think that there somewhere is in statute somewhere language that deals with the what happens in the case of a new administration, and I'm just not sure if it applies to this.
Representative Broad, do you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Representative Portman, I appreciate you bringing forward some ideas for transparency and improved information. I truly do. I question Section 3. I'm trying to understand how this actually would work and whether we're just adding a lot of information that most people you can get if you ask for it, but I'm just wondering if the process of compiling it isn't burdensome.
Representative Harmon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rod, presumably this information is already put together. As the commissioner of each of these agencies should be, they are, and I would imagine they are, looking at this exact set of information as they're making their budgeting decisions and as they're putting together their requests each year. And as throughout the year, as they look to see whether the agency is meeting its goals and where they are in their expenditures. So basically what I'm asking for is information that already exists in the executive branch to be provided to legislators. And it's true that you could request this information, but I'll tell you it's been extremely difficult, excruciatingly difficult, to find out this level of detail from the Department of Transportation.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Portman, can you talk a little bit about Section 1 that... the way I read it is that preliminary drafts of any sort or work product would be now public. So any scratching of ideas on napkins and any scratching of ideas on paper would be public data. And it just seems to me that as a budget is presented, it's natural for any entity to go through a process of changing their minds and sorting and juggling priorities to come out with the priorities that they decide to come out with. I'm just trying to figure out then why that change and how does this actually improve the process.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, what this is getting at is the idea that people within the department submit proposed budgets to the commissioners and their staff. And then the commissioners in turn propose the budget to the governor. And I think that it would be worthwhile to see what changes are made through that process. I believe that the experts on health policy in the state of Minnesota are in the Minnesota Department of Health, below the commissioner status, people who've been doing this for decades. And I would like to see, for example, whether somebody has proposed to spend $4 million studying mesothelioma and whether that's zeroed out by the commissioner or not. Similarly, within the Minnesota Department of Transportation, as the budget documents work their way up to the commissioner and then to the governor, I would like to know if the head of the bridge department has urged a different method of funding bridge replacement so that it doesn't take an entire appropriation from a MnDOT district to replace so-called budget buster bridges. I think since it's public dollars that we're talking about spending, and since the non-political, non-partisan people within the agencies are the real experts on how to spend the money effectively and achieve the results we want to achieve, I think that their work product should be public information.
Representative Martin.
I'll pass up there.
Representative Peterson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. You're not directing this just at MnDOT, except you're using that as a point of reference. Is that over the top in my question? Second question is going back to Section 3. When you start talking about on item line 2.32, I understand the list of employees and their titles. When you start publicly listing salaries, instead of it being transparent, it's indecent exposure, in my opinion, because that is just bait for people to talk and complain. It sets employee against employee, department against department, and you do that in any company, and you start doing that in your company or mine or many others, you're creating a situation that you may not want to start happening. And I can understand we can ask for it, but you start publicly printing that every year in reports, you're going to start a brush fire that we may not be able to put out.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, with regard to MnDOT, I don't think that my reference to them is over the top. That's just my experience. As a legislator, I serve on three finance committees. I serve on the State Government Finance, Higher Education Finance, and Department of Transportation Finance. And in Transportation Finance, it's like making policy wading through cattails. It's a little bit difficult with the sort of PowerPoint overview type information that we get from MnDOT to make really good decisions. And it has not been easy to get more detailed information when requested. So I use that example because that's my experience. And that's part of what was the genesis for the legislation, is my frustration that in wanting to spend more money on roads and wanting to spend more money on transit, to try to find out if we have unnecessary or duplicative administration within the agency, it's very difficult to find that out based on the information that we get. The second point that you raised was the salary information. That information is already publicly available. If you want to go to the Department of Education, for example, and get a list of all the employees and all their salaries, you can already do that. So to the extent that employees would feel that that there's some problem with publishing their information, it's already out there. And I'm sure that coworkers know each other's salaries at these public offices, just as anybody in the state of Minnesota can find out our salaries.
I understand what you're saying, and I understand it's public, but I'm still saying, from a management standpoint, in my opinion, it is very inappropriate, and it does not have any redeeming value for the personnel in this whole state and all the various agencies. And I'm sensing that you're going after MnDOT, but you're dragging in with them a whole lot of other departments that may not be appropriate either, in my opinion.
Representative Harmon, what was your reference to PowerPoint?
Oh, it's just the budget information that we were presented with in the Transportation Finance Committee.
I believe the technical term is PowerPoint fluff.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond.
Yes, Representative Hartman.
Representative Peterson, it's really not about MnDOT. It's about the contrast between what I did at John Battlepart in my position as Vice President and General Counsel and what I do here as a legislator. And I know when I go door knocking from door to door, the taxpayers that I talk to think that I'm getting a lot more information than what I get in this book. And they think that I'm able to find waste, fraud, and abuse based on the information that I get and the votes that I cast on here. And I don't think, based upon the information that we get on budgets, we can really say to our constituents when we're at each of their doors that we're presented with the full information we need to find the waste, fraud, and abuse if there is any. And it's really not about MnDOT. And to the point of the salaries, let's just imagine one situation where it's highly useful. And again, I'm going to reference transportation because that's my area of interest and that's where I've worked the hardest since I got elected. We need to know if we have competitive salaries to have some of the best engineers in the state working for the state agency, or if our pay scale is out of sync with the professionals in the marketplace, such that we're sort of at the mercy of a consulting firm.
You have just confirmed my worst fear, that the 134 state legislatures are going to start deciding salaries and whether it's adequate and it's not. You're creating a micromanagement that is not appropriate. And I think your bill is well-intended, but that salary piece, I think, is going to come back to bite, and it's totally inappropriate.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was going to start by making the point that Representative Fortman made, is that the salary information is public. Mm-hmm. But instead, I'll change it to advice to Representative Peterson, that if he thinks that's such a bad idea, why haven't we seen a bill from you to remove that information from the state register to make it private information if you think it's inappropriate for the public to see it.
Representative Pearson, you don't need to respond.
No, I don't think I will.
Representative Kahn. That's it. Representative Winkler.
I expected a response, though.
Representative Kahn goes next.
Okay.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I would actually offer a response, which is it may not be the best idea to put an individual name and an individual title and an individual salary in a report that is made to the legislature. It could potentially be done by bands of salary or classification and number of employees and essentially get to the same point without identifying it to a particular individual. And I think the distinction between information that is public but that you have to make an effort to get by request and information that is provided in an easily accessible report is there is a difference. So I take your point, but I think that the salary information is important, and we could get to it in a way that would, I think, preserve some of that information. And I just really want to thank Representative Fortman for doing this bill, because the thing that shocked me the most as a first-term representative was the budget presentations that we got. I thought we came here to make decisions, but based on the agency budgets, I don't know what decisions we make, except we kind of hit the gas a little more in one area or hit the brake a little in another, and we have no idea which direction the car is really going in. And I think this would actually make public decision-making much more worthwhile without getting to the point of micromanaging.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple points. First of all, as to whether this is targeted at MnDOT, obviously that's Representative Portman's area of expertise, but I know I was a member of this group that met over the interim, a government accountability and reform group, and I can't remember MnDOT ever specifically coming up at all. This was one of the sort of consensus items from the group. But I also just want to emphasize, too, I see this as really giving us more depth and context, because as Representative Winkler just said, really what we have is a set of numbers, and we're really steered in the direction often, I think, because of time constraints and other reasons, in the direction of looking at a present expenditure and assuming that the prior legislature got it right, that was the right expenditure, that was just the right amount for that time, and do we want to go a little more, do we want to go a little less, instead of understanding whether or not, in the context of the entire agency and its mission, that expenditure even belongs at all. And so I think more information is almost always better, and I really commend you for bringing this so forward.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would absolutely support trying to find that waste, fraud, and abuse. I think that there's plenty out there, and generally what we seem to do in our budgeting process is what we did last year plus. So I support that. I think, however, that we'd probably get there a little better by doing more of a zero-based budgeting type approach, where every proposal has to come forward every year and be justified. So I think that there's some other ways to get there. But a couple concerns that I'm trying to just work through, because I think theoretically I like the idea, but I am struggling with the details of it, and I'm not sure I support some of the details. But I'm concerned a little bit about the demand from the legislative branch to the internal processes of the executive branch in terms of making the decision-making the tools they use public from a demand from the legislature in terms of separation of powers. And then I also am wondering, does this then apply to the legislature in our work product? And are we going to have to save every piece of paper and make all of our pieces of paper public and all of our, I would support actually making all of our emails public, but right now there is no categorization on the legislative branch related to that type of documentation as well. So how does this relate to us as the legislative branch in terms of making us as transparent as you're requesting of the executive branch?
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I presume that everything that a legislator produces is public information and would be publicly available to somebody who requests it, with the exception of attorney-client privilege for work product. If a legislator is involved in that kind of a relationship with somebody in-house research or outside counsel.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr. Shepard can help me understand if it is, because it's my understanding that House Research can't disclose who they're working with and what they're working on, so I'm not sure how that's public.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, the issue of data practices in the legislature is involved somewhat a different issue than the executive branch, because there's a constitutional speech and debate clause privilege in which no member can be forced to give up data that's related to the sphere of legislating. And so it is different than the executive branch. Also, I believe that the current interpretation of the Data Practices Act is that it does not apply to the legislature, so whether a legislator chooses to provide data is up to them.
Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that was much more eloquently said, but that's somewhat my point, is that the situation for us is very different than what we're demanding through this legislation of the executive branch to expose absolutely every piece of their work product is a pretty significant request, and I don't think that the committee should take that request lightly.
Mr. Chair, and maybe Representative Kahn, the two of you could help, but it's my understanding that this is the way agencies used to submit information. It used to be public at the professional level, and that was changed during the Carlson administration. I'd be interested to know if that's, in fact, it's, the case. But I think the difference, because we're not asking conversations or proposals from the commissioner to the governor to be public. We're talking about professional staff up through the agency process. And in the context of political decision-making is where we're talking about things not being public information. And that's more at the agency head to the governor level than it is professional staff to commissioner level, much as the research staff to legislator and the inner workings of the legislature itself are all political type decisions, and there's a long tradition of not having that be public information. So I think there is a big difference here when we're talking about professional line expert employees and the proposals that they're putting forward to make the government work better. And I think it brings us back, this proposal brings us back to a time when the agencies were less politicized.
Did you have a question, Representative Winkler, at the beginning, or was, and were you seeking a historical perspective, which could be dangerous?
Mr. Chair, all conversations go through the chair, and if you would prefer to address it or not refer to any other members, that's your prerogative.
Representative Winkler, I'm not going to answer your question, the first part of your question. Mr. Shepard might be able to, but I hesitate to go any further to my right.
Mr. Chair.
Was there a question?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry. Representative Hartman.
I can't offer an amendment since I'm not a member of this committee, but I would suggest to address Representative Pearson's concern that on line 2.32, we delete the comma after employees and instead put an apostrophe there to make it plural possessive, cross out the word there, and delete the comma after titles. So that the new paren 3 would be a list of all employees' titles and their salaries.
Representative Hartman, I'm going to have Mr. Shepard confirm that that works. So, Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, I believe that that works as stated, and I will write it down for Ms. Anderson. The new language would read, the Clause 3 would say, a list of all employees' titles and their salaries.
And, Representative Hartman, I would move that amendment for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And is there any discussion to that amendment? Representative Peterson.
Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion? And we have the amendment in writing, so it is not an oral amendment. It is a written amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Olson, I'm sorry, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, since you can't do amendments, I thought there might be another one that you'd like. And I'd like to ask on page one, if we deleted on 1.10 and 1.14, if we reestablished the stricken language and deleted the new language, how would that affect your bill? There's actually a couple provisions back in the bill that I like, but this is the provision that I don't like, and I was wondering how that, from your perspective, would affect your bill.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, I would oppose that amendment. I think it's really important that we see the preliminary drafts of these budgets and what decisions are made about how to spend the taxpayer dollars.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to move that amendment. It's just, to me, a basis to not vote for the bill. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Any further discussion to the bill as amended? Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3113 as amended be passed and be referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Representative Kalin is with us.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. And members, Senate File 1218 is the military and overseas voting bill that we've discussed quite a bit at length before. Before getting to the substance of the bill, I do have a cleanup amendment.
Well, Representative, why don't you move your bill first so we have the bill before us?
I'd like to move Senate File 1218 so we have the bill before us.
And where is it going to go?
I believe we're going to the General Register.
All right, so that motion is before us. Then, Representative Kalin, you have an amendment?
I'd also like to move the A18 amendment you should have in your packet.
All right. And Representative Kalin moves the A18 amendment. Let's put the amendment on so the bill's in the order that you want. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is amended. So, Representative Kalin, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, Senate File 1218 is the military and overseas voting bill. The bill is the result of quite a bit of work by the Department of Defense, who every year does an annual review of the voting procedures state by state and their ability to enfranchise or create barriers for American citizens living overseas, whether in active duty uniform, members of the Foreign Service, missionaries, or support staff or family, or private contractors serving this country in various capacities. After doing a review of Minnesota statutes in 2006, they began a process first connecting with Secretary Kiffmeyer, and then after the change in the Secretary of State's office, Secretary Ritchie. And what you see before you is largely the result of initiatives by the Pentagon that have then been actually narrowed significantly so that we can be assured that Minnesota's tradition of secure voting continues. You have in your packet this letter from Mr. Weedman, the Deputy Director of the Federal Voting Assistance Project at the Department of Defense. And members, we took an oath when we get sworn in to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Minnesota. the Commander-in-Chief has asked our service members to serve as defenders of democracy overseas and our citizens overseas in whatever capacity they work or live overseas are ambassadors of democracy. And the core foundation of democracies is the right to vote, the constitutional franchise of voting. This bill removes significant barriers of bureaucracy and red tape from American citizens overseas being able to exercise their democratic rights. It's very important that we cover everybody, as you'll read in the letter from the Pentagon. And members, I think we may hear a little bit of discussion about some politics, but this bill is a question of whether we're going to do the right thing. And we will have before us this choice about whether we do the right thing or do something else. And we might hear some discussion about what the governor might do with this bill. We've actually listened to his concerns, the concerns of his staff. We continue to be meeting and discussing this bill with his staff, working towards reaching consensus and agreement, including conference calls with the Pentagon and continuing discussion. I can't say for certain that the governor will sign this bill, but what I can say for certain is that the governor should sign this bill. I can also say for certain that there are implications to advancing any bill other than one that covers all American citizens overseas who should be voting in Minnesota. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Gary Kaiser.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Members of Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Kaiser. I live in Roseville, Minnesota. I'm the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council. I represent the 402,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota. They're also the National Guardsmen and Reservists and active military people are part of our organizations. They have representatives there that we meet every month. I'm going to speak to the military portion of it. As a Vietnam veteran in 1968, on my first tour there, I wanted to vote, and I had my parents send me the absentee ballot stuff. And I feel that I think I was the only guy in our company that voted. But I doubt if it ever actually got there, and I actually did vote. But my candidate won, so that was okay. But what I want to make sure of is that...
oh, my God. The Pentagon on the horn, Mr. Chair.
I don't have to pay the $5, right?
Representative Kalin, though.
Thank you, Mr. Craig.
We in the veterans community want to be able to have these new... these soldiers and sailors, all these military people are out there now, are able to vote and have it done in an expeditiously way and not have it be so cumbersome. Of course, we didn't have computers or anything like that. As far as we voted to support the military part of this stuff, and so has the military affairs people, they want that changed too. The other details of it is what we feel that the legislature and the governor have to work out, but we want to make sure that this is done. It has to be done quickly because in order for the all the technical things to be involved with this, it needs to be done in a pretty quick order so they can get out there to the people in the field so they actually can vote in November. Because if it's delayed much longer, it's not going to happen. So for the state of Minnesota, it is imperative that our soldiers and sailors and all those folks that I have been in contact with, they have an opportunity to vote any way that they'd like. I thought I turned it off.
All right. Any further? I have an amendment. The DE1 amendment. Representative Broad, is that your amendment?
It is my amendment.
All right. Representative Broad, are you moving the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the DE1 amendment. Where is it? DE1 amendment.
All right.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is an amendment you saw yesterday. What I'm trying to do with this amendment is to get done exactly what Mr. Kaiser would like to get done, which is the military provisions of this bill. I think, unfortunately, the military provisions are being weighed down by the controversy in the other sections of the bill, which will not get signed into law. So what I'd like to do is ensure that our military men and women can vote who are overseas, including my brother, would be able to vote this fall and make sure that their votes are counted properly. And what this amendment is, Mr. Chairman, is Representative Hilty's bill, which is a good bill, which was worked on, as I said yesterday, with the Department of Military Affairs, with the National Guard, and has their support through the governor. The governor will sign this bill. It's something that we can make sure that the military provisions are taken care of without worrying about whether he will or will not sign the other one and then playing political games with blame. We can't blame anybody but ourselves if we don't get the military portions done. The governor, in his veto message, indicated that these provisions that are being brought forward by Representative Kalin are well-intentioned, but they don't do the job. And so, Mr. Chairman, House File 3455, which is contained in this amendment, gets the job done for the military folks and will get signed into law, and I appreciate the member's support.
All right. Representative Hilty, do you want to comment? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, I can only reiterate what I said yesterday, which is that I believe that the provisions in Representative Kalin's bill are clearly more comprehensive. I don't believe that we should be disenfranchising any citizen of the United States, no matter what their circumstances are, if they are otherwise eligible to vote. And my preference certainly is for the Kalin bill.
All right. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just point out to the committee that there are two Minnesota residents who serve as ambassadors who would not be able to vote if we adopt the DE1 amendment. Families of our service members overseas would not be able to vote. If there are covert CIA agents who are Minnesota residents, they can only be covered if we cover everybody. Members, I was at the wake of a constituent about 8 weeks ago, actually I think 12 weeks ago now, who was killed in combat in Iraq. He wore a uniform, but he's not active duty military, private contractor. Their targets just the same. They represent our country just the same. Mr. Juneau would not be able to vote were he alive today under the DE1 amendment. Further, it's important that this committee and the legislature understand that the amendment, would we adopt it, would violate the Voting Rights Act and could potentially invite Department of Justice intervention in our election, and we could be treated like the Deep South during the Jim Crow era. It's a significant step backwards. Members, I urge you to vote no.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that impassioned plea, Representative Kalin. In the DE1 amendment, I was being facetious. In the DE1 amendment, if you could take a look, sir, and just show me the two things that, and without the emotion, if you could stick to the facts and show me in here how these folks would be precluded from voting absentee, and then specifically, since you brought it up, I'd like to know in here how this is going to create some Jim Crow type law and violate the Help America Vote Act.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the provision, the federal law is that we are responding to is actually not the Help America Vote Act, it's the UOCAVA, Uniform and Overseas Citizens Voting Act. I direct you to line 3.20 to line 3.27 and so on, where military personnel are carved out from and treated differently. And as you know, being treated differently is discrimination. positive or negative. We do not create special classes in deciding who has the right to vote and who does not, for whom we will create special procedures and for whom we will not.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hammer.
Well, actually, Representative Kalin, the states have the authority to regulate their elections and determine how they're made. Your argument, if that's your belief, that this is going to create some disparate treatment or some discriminatory treatment, I don't see it. Again, could you point out to me where this is going to preclude these folks from voting by absentee ballot?
Representative Kalin, sorry.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, actually, the concerns were raised not initially by myself, but by the Pentagon themselves.
Representative Emmer.
You know, Representative Kalin, if you're going to come in here and make such emotionally charged statements, I would appreciate, rather than hiding behind some a bureaucrat in a different state in a big building that we don't know where he or she offices, if you could tell me where in here it is that it's going to preclude these folks from voting by absentee ballot, it would help me a lot.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, as you remember from last year, the success rate for overseas voters, including those in uniform, but for all overseas voters, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 out of every 5 succeeds in having their vote count today. By choosing to remove those barriers from one class and not from another, that in and of itself creates suspicion and could get us in significant trouble. And you are correct, Representative Emmer, on one part, that the states do facilitate and oversee the election process until and unless there are issues of special classes being created, at which point we do invite scrutiny from the Department of Justice. And I believe that the DE-1 amendment would be a significant step backwards, members.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, to the amendment, I have a question for Representative Broad. I'm just trying to make sure I understand your amendment. Essentially, under your amendment, we're creating sort of a special electronic absentee ballot process for members of the military. And the primary difference between your amendment and Representative Kalin's bill is the people who would be eligible for participating in that particular kind of application. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Winkler, actually, there's a number of differences between this amendment and Representative Kalin's bill. The emergency powers provision in Representative Kalin's bill is not a part of this amendment. It also changes the delivery back to automatic or non-electronic delivery back. It's the delivery out is electronic, so delivery back is by mail.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I guess I'm wondering, you discussed the process and the willingness of the governor to sign the bill. The question I have is, why, in addition to the things that you mentioned that are different, why also would you not include missionary families, diplomats, families of the military, etc.? Why? What's your motivation for doing it differently, aside from what the governor is willing to sign?
Sure. Representative Winkler, what we're trying to get at is a provision in Representative Kalin's bill that does, essentially will allow folks who have never lived or resided in the United States or in the state of Minnesota to vote in our state.
Representative Winkler. Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, so under that provision, then, those people, if other states had the same bill, they wouldn't be allowed to vote in any state. Is that correct?
Representative Broad.
Representative Winkler, what this amendment is trying to do is move forward provisions which can actually allow our military men and women to have their votes counted. And we can discuss all sorts of different things about the details on the amendment. I'd be happy to work with you on language related to this bill. It's not my bill. I just think it's a very, very good idea, and I don't want the situation of our 1 out of 5 of our military men and women's votes being counted. We had the option last year to move our primary up, which would have solved all of the problems that we're facing here today, because it would have made for a much more streamlined process and would have given the ability for those votes to be counted in a much, much better fashion. But since we didn't do that, I want to make sure that we can at least get that provision signed into law, and we can continue discussing the other provisions that are contained in Representative Kalin's bill. Now, the other thing that Representative Kalin mentioned is that from the UOCAVA or from the Federal Voting Assistance Program thing that he handed out is that they're trying to find consistency between the states, yet he mentioned in his testimony that he's narrowed down his bill dramatically from the other states, and so there is no consistency. And so I think what we need to do is do what's good for Minnesota and do what's good for our military men and women.
Chair, just a follow-up. So, I mean, that I'm trying to address the facts of the amendment rather than the emotion. If other states had a provision which prevented people who had never resided in the state of Minnesota or resided in the United States proper from voting in the state of Minnesota, if all 49 other states had that same provision, would there be any way for those military family members, missionary families, diplomatic corps families to vote? Would there be any way for them to vote in any state?
Representative Braun.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Winkler, I would love for Representative Kalin to answer that question because I couldn't answer related to what all the other states are doing. I can't answer that question.
What's your amendment?
Representative Winkler? Braun.
Well,
Representative Kalin, do you wish to respond?
Yes, Mr. Chair. First, on two misstatements that we just heard about my bill. First, there is no electronic return of ballots under Senate File 1218 as presented, and so any claim otherwise is not true. Second, the statement that supposedly my bill, that I suggested that my bill was narrowed from other states, no, it was narrowed from the Pentagon's proposals. The Pentagon wants as broad an enfranchisement agenda and as broad of enfranchisement legislation. When reviewing those proposals, we narrowed them significantly in several areas to make sure that they would work with Minnesota's secure election tradition.
Right.
To the question of Representative Winkler, I've had a lot of questions about that section, too, that's in my bill that's missing from Representative Broad's amendment and also that Representative Broad alluded to. I believe that there are on so many other states, at least it's in the double digits, I can't remember whether it's 11 or 18, but there are many other states who do so. They are United States citizens. You're correct, Representative Winkler, that the subjects of Section 2 in my bill would not be enfranchised by the Broad Amendment and are often missionary, children of missionaries who've spent their entire lives overseas but are United States citizens, or children of service members who've grown up on base and should be given the right to vote as they are in other states.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kalin, how many people do you suggest are disenfranchised today that would be disenfranchised continually under the amendment?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, I'm not sure whether you're speaking only to Section 2 or to the whole bill. What we do know is that there are thousands and thousands of votes. There are 20,000 Minnesota service members, roughly, and 60,000 total Minnesota residents and citizens who are covered under the overseas and military voting bill. And so I think that gives you a general neighborhood of whether it's one or whether it's 60,001. We should be concerned when Minnesotans and citizens are not guaranteed the constitutional franchise of voting.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I'm trying to get to is an actual number of those who have never resided in the United States who are going to be, in your view, enfranchised under your bill. I am looking for a number because what's going to end up happening is that we know that the bill is not going to get signed into law. So the 60,000, the 60,000 that you just suggested will not be enfranchised under your proposal. So
there's the motion before it, the Broad Amendment.
Mr. Chairman,
could we speak to the Broad Amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to find out how many people have never lived in the United States who are suggesting are going to be enfranchised under your bill. I think it's very relevant information for us to have to make the decision.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I think it's best if we stick to the substance of the bill and to what's right and not get caught up in the projections about what will and will not happen in terms of political process. Second, Hennepin County receives dozens of phone calls related to this very specific provision, Hennepin being, of course, the largest, most populous county. And so if you extrapolate out based on population. We are talking about hundreds of Minnesotans that are American citizens who should be granted the franchise of voting, who are currently disenfranchised by our statutes.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kalin, of the dozens of phone calls that you're aware of, can you tell me how many of them were made by the same people and how many of them actually were disenfranchised?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, I think of this. We're getting a little fine, too far down into...
Everyone, we're on the broad amendment, right. So could we stick to the broad amendment?
Mr. Chairman, all I'm trying to do is get real numbers. I think for us to make a decision, we should have real numbers. Excuse me. And when we talk about dozens of phone calls, while that's interesting, they're not real numbers. And so whether you're going to vote for or against my amendment, I think that that's what I'm trying to get at, is what are the real numbers. It's easy to use big numbers and say this and that and the other, and I'm guilty of it too. We all are. But the fact that maybe that not Representative Emmer, but the fact of the matter is that what I'm trying to do is get information. When you say dozens of phone calls, what does that mean? That's what I'm trying to get at, Mr. Chairman. And
All right.
I think it is relevant to the amendment.
Representative Broad, you've made your point. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Broad, I just want to go back to a line of questioning we had a minute ago. I'm wondering, under Section 5 of your proposed EE amendment, what other categories of persons other than those serving in the military do you believe, as a general matter, since you're very involved in elections issue on this committee and elsewhere, what category of citizens other than military personnel do you believe, as a matter of policy, should be entitled to this electronic transmission method? Is there anyone else that you believe, just as a matter of good policy, ought to be entitled to this?
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, what this amendment does is that it allows for the electronic transmission to our military men and women. And so in wanting to make sure that we're continuing to talk about the amendment, I would really encourage your support of this provision.
I'll take that as a non-answer, and I'll take that as a very revealing non-answer, because I would imagine that if asked and put to a vote, there are many members of this body who would not support this kind of method for other members of our society, and I think that's too bad, and it's all too telling. I would say, in terms of one thing that Representative Broad and I do agree on, I think, and I think it's very relevant to this debate, is part of the problem here, and she and I have been working together on this issue, is our primary is ridiculously late in the state. And we are tied for second latest in the country. We have a matter of 8 weeks between our primary and the general election, and between certifying the ballots, getting them printed, and mailing them out, it makes it extremely difficult for members who serve overseas, for anyone living overseas for that matter, whether in the military or in business, living in France or wherever, to have their ballots counted. You know, when we were collaborating on the early primary bill, we had folks saying that if you've ever been part of a recount in this state, and this was a conservative Republican, by the way, Annette Meeks, who said this, and it was really interesting testimony, she said there will always be two piles of ballots that we don't count. First is the spoiled ballots, people who just filled it out wrong, and second are the ballots that didn't get there in time. And the lion's share of those who didn't get there on time are those who live overseas, and the lion's share of those are people in the military. And Representative Broad and I, though we disagree on when the earlier primary should be, she thinks it should be in August, I prefer June, because I think everyone's kind of at the cabin or out playing in July or August. I think that's something that, as a legislature, we really have to think about. We're the second latest in the United States, and we could alleviate a whole lot of problems if we moved it earlier.
Well, members, we're on the broad motion. So if we could stay to that debate, please. I know that we've drifted twice. And let's send Kalin to the broad motion.
Mr. Chair, I think before we vote on the amendments, I think Representative Simon referenced the dog days of summer. I think somebody knows even greater heat. And from having been there himself, I think it would be helpful to chime in as John Kingry, who... served as the Judge Advocate General in Kuwait. Mr. Kingry, if you might be able to come up and have some thoughts about the and did voter outreach in Kuwait in the Iraq War, and might have some thoughts.
Representative Kalin, I don't mind him coming up, but I would prefer he speak to the broad amendment, and because that's the motion before us.
And he will speak to the differentiation between just a military and then having a more general.
All right, I'm serious now. To the broad amendment, and not any extraneous data at this point. To the broad amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Kingry. I'm speaking in my personal capacity, not in my professional capacity with my for my employer. I'm currently a lieutenant colonel in the 214th Legal Support Organization at Fort Snelling. I'm a member of the United States Army Reserve, and as Representative Kalin said, I spent 6 months in 2006 as Chief of Legal Assistance at Camp Arif John, Kuwait, during the dog days of summer. With regard to this amendment, I know it raises a number of policy issues. I specifically want to talk about the disenfranchisement of the some of the non-military folks there. In Kuwait and the whole theater over there, Iraq, Afghanistan, you have almost as many civilian contractors as you have military folks. Everywhere from IT people, when I would check out my weapon in the morning, the person handed to me was a civilian. And I would say to all of you that they are just as much in harm's way as the soldier walking down the street because of the type of war that we are fighting over there. They have mortars coming in, they have rockets coming in. You have civilians getting injured and killed over there. With regard to military families, I believe that military families should be allowed to vote. You have families that are stationed in Germany. Their husbands or wives may be stationed downrange in Kuwait or Afghanistan or Iraq. It seems to me they're not over there because they want to be over there. They're over there because they want to be with their spouses. And it seems to me that those individuals should be allowed to vote, which is, I understand, the original bill. It would allow them to do. Again, there's a lot of other policy issues in here. I'm talking about those individuals that are non-military that should be allowed to vote.
Right. Representative Olson, to the Broad Amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I was going to try to reiterate in another way the question of Representative Emmer. Representative Kalin, I never really heard you answer his question. And in to the Broad Amendment, I'd like to know if you can highlight in your bill how it will make sure these people can vote. As Representative Emmer asked in Representative Broad's amendment, that it will prevent it. But in a way of getting at the same point, I'd like to see the comparison of provisions to highlight that concern. And while you're looking for that, Representative Kalin, I'd like to note that it's been made very clear that your bill, as before us, Representative Kalin, will not be signed by the governor. I can understand you passing it out of the committee and maybe even passing it off the floor. But I just want to caution us that if we push this forward, I'm very concerned that we'd be using the military to try to get provisions through that the governor would not sign. And that leaves me with grave concerns. That's the only comment I have.
Members, we're beginning to ask the same question again, and I don't know how many times Representative Kalin can give an answer to the same question, but answer this question, then I'm going to the next person on the list. So, Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I think I think we should not be talking about motives. I believe it's even a violation of Masons and our House rules, and so I'd ask that we not do so, and I'll assume that it was just an honest mistake and not speak too much to that. To the substantive question, line 3.727 in the DE-1 amendment sets up a electronic transmission of ballot process only for those in the military. Line 5. Section 9 on my point that begins on line 5.25 in the bill does not distinguish between one class and another, and that's the main point, Representative Olson, setting up two different classes.
Representative Kahn, to the Broad Amendment.
Just a point.
To the Broad Amendment.
Yes, it is to the Broad Amendment, Mr. Chairman, and I would appreciate it if you'd let me say what I want to say before you start preliminarily calling me out of order.
Representative Kahn, I am not calling you out of order. I'm clarifying what your question will be.
One of the arguments for the Broad Amendment is that if we don't adopt it, the governor will veto this bill and we will not achieve our goal of facilitating military voting. I would just like to point out the legislative timetable. We are dealing with a Senate file. I'm not sure what the differences are, but this bill goes from here right to the floor, I believe, and so we can certainly very quickly get this bill to the governor's office, and I don't know
how optimistic people are about how quickly we're getting out of here, but I would predict that should the governor decide to veto it and face the criticisms which are being made in advance in this committee, there will be plenty of time to redo another bill with based on just the military enablement, if that's what we decide to do. So I just think it's in, we've heard it three times at least in this committee. I think the fact that the governor will veto this is a non-necessary argument.
Okay, Rep. Broad, last word.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I guess politics do matter. I mean, if the goal is to camp something on the governor's desk, which he's already said is not satisfactory to him, we can go back to the tax bill that we just did the same thing with, or we're going to do the same thing with, but common sense came to bear and everybody came together. All I'm trying to do is give an option for us to come together ahead of time. We don't need to go through that. We don't need to camp something on his desk, point fingers at him, and say, you're a bad guy, you're a good guy. We can actually get something done, and then we can work on the other language in a non-controversial way. So all I'm trying to do is get a piece of a very important puzzle moved along, and there's nothing to say we can't continue talking about the language in the bill. Absolutely nothing to say that we can't continue doing that. But all I'm trying to do is get at least one non-controversial piece moved forward, just like this committee is trying to do with the bundled bills. Let's move something forward that can get signed into law, so at least a portion of it can actually come to be and come to pass. So I think that it is relevant, the fact that the veto message designated this. You know, you can only choose so many things in a bill to identify as problems or priority problems in a veto message. This was one of them. I just want to get something done.
All right. We've had a thorough discussion. So all those in favor of the broad amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Nays prevail. The motion is not adopted. Representative Kalin, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think a lot has been said, probably more than enough already. The issue of the veto message, I do want to point out that Section 15 and Senate File 1218, with the exception of the rulemaking that we deleted in the A18 amendment, Section 15 is a section that I worked on with counsel last session and with Senator Erickson Ropes, and actually is significantly different from the emergency powers provision that was alluded to in the governor's veto message of the con rest bill last year. Further, I believe, or excuse me, the con vessel, I can't remember who your Senate companion was. Further, the other issues addressed in the veto message, we believe that the Pentagon has been very forthright in addressing those concerns. The only issue that is out there, and I believe is just an issue for us to have to decide whether we want to disenfranchise those missionary children and military children, is that remaining Section 2. Otherwise, all parts of the veto message relating to this bill, we believe we have either changed the provision or done adequate, I hope done adequate education on the impacts of the provisions in here and the motivations for why.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kalin, your response to my question helped me find something that stands out even more than what Representative Broad is highlighting. I'd like to see Section 15 of the bill be deleted. The emergency powers provision, I think, is very onerous and quite offensive to potential integrity of elections under the circumstances, and I believe we should be removing that provision at least, and would appeal members to support this motion.
All right. So, Representative Olson, you're making a motion to delete that section. That is correct.
All right.
Representative Kalin, to the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I urge members to vote no. If we have a forest fire erupt in northern Minnesota on October 30th, a few days before the election, this provision would, after an emergency filed and declared by the governor, and this is a significant change from our original bill, after the emergency has been filed and declared by the governor, those who are putting their lives in harm's way would be extended the franchise of voting. If we delete this section, actually we'll be almost in essence guaranteeing that any mobilization of our service members or any support personnel
or anybody responding to a natural disaster or other disaster in Minnesota would not be able to vote. We don't schedule disasters. We respond to them, as I know we've discussed in this committee. I urge members to vote no.
Any further discussion? Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kalin, right now this can occur. It just can occur with the collaboration between the executive branch. So it's not, what this does is that it shifts it directly only into the Secretary of State's purview, whereas right now the Secretary of State, the Governor, and Attorney General and Auditor, from what I understand, participate in making these decisions. So essentially you're just camping all the ability to enact elections into one body. Is that correct?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brodno.
All those
Mr.
in favor, Representative Brodno.
Well, Representative Kalin, can you tell me how it works then?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, members, the governor declares an emergency, files a declaration of emergency under Section 12.31. Voters are central voters are mobilized, and the Secretary of State, while everyone else in the is working on the emergency operations plan, the Secretary of State will be taking care of making sure that folks vote. As you know, the Executive Council, I believe it is. The Community Executive Council will also be meeting during that time, and but it's just to make sure that as everyone else is enacting the governor's executive order 0404 and 0708 and the state emergency operations plan, that voting procedures are indeed expedited for the narrow universe of folks that will be affected.
Well, what I'm trying to find out, Representative Kalin, I can read that. I appreciate that explanation, but what I'm trying to find out is how it differs from current law. Currently, the Executive Council can meet, and it's been, I think, our experience in the state of Minnesota that when we do have disasters, people come together in a pretty remarkable way. They absolutely do. And so it seems to me that the Executive Council can move in this direction. I just don't understand the need to change to camp all this direction into one body. So that's what I'm trying to better understand is why the change? Why the change?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, members, the provision, the general provision of emergency powers is requested by the Pentagon. We narrowed it in the original House file. The Senate file represents an even further narrowing in response to the governor's concerns. As you said, Representative Broad, the Executive Council can meet. They do not need to meet in those first days following a disaster and or an emergency, excuse me. And so that's why this provision is necessary.
Representative Olson, to your motion. Representative Olson.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I really believe this provision goes much further than it's perceived. This is not just if the governor declares an emergency. You look on 915. Says, or if a natural disaster, or armed conflict involving the United States Armed Forces, or mobilization of these forces, including National Guard and reserve components of this state, makes substantial compliance with the Uniform and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act impossible or unreasonable. So just mobilization, making it unreasonable. Well, current law is apparently unreasonable because it's the reason for the bill. In the last election, this could have been declared based on what that said. I think this language is very flawed and we should be voting this down.
Representative Emmer.
Just a question, Mr. Chairman. The motion, assuming we ever get to a vote on the actual bill, is the motion to send it where?
To the General Register.
Okay. Well, this is, I realize, a policy committee, but I think it's important to this proposed oral amendment by Representative Olson that what he just brought up is that this is not, at least the way Representative Kalin is represented, that it would only occur in the event of a natural disaster or some other conflict, because it does broaden it to just mobilization of, for instance, the National Guard. And the question that I would have is, do we know anything about, and I, if it's out of order, I'm sure you'll tell me, but do we know anything about the cost that, it's not just the policy of putting it into the Secretary of State's office, that the Secretary of State, whoever that might be, may determine whether or not special procedures are necessary, but what's the ultimate cost of that?
Representative Kalin, is there a fiscal note to this bill?
Mr. Chair and members, we have removed the cost to the Secretary of State. The fiscal impact is zero. When we adopted the A18 amendment, we removed the rules provision. And second, I'd like to just point out that in line 9.17, the condition is whether substantial compliance will be impossible or unreasonable. And members, again, I urge you to vote no on the Olson amendment.
All right. Representative Emmer.
Did I miss something? Did I miss an amendment? Because the... that was it?
8.29.
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin didn't answer the question. First off, as you'll probably find out, the term substantial compliance is a wonderful thing for the court. It doesn't solve any problem. It actually creates one. But I was talking about up a couple of lines, and it doesn't look like the on page 9, line 919 is not gone. If I am mistaken, please correct me, but it says, by emergency order, special procedures or requirements necessary to facilitate absentee voting. There's got to be some cost to that, if it's going right to the general register, do we know what that cost is?
Representative Cameron.
Chair, Representative Emmer, that cost can be absorbed by the Secretary of State's office.
Is there somebody here that can tell us what it cost? Well, we have the Secretary of State's office here if they want to respond to that, but we're rapidly running out of time.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Ms. Frazier, you want to respond to the cost question? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Secretary of State's office. If we did have to invoke the emergency orders, the emergency power section, our staff would need to take some action. But as Representative Kalin noted, we believe it wouldn't be that expensive and something that we could absorb.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Frazier, what's it going to do to the counties, the local authorities? Are they going to have any involvement in this? Are they going to have to administer this in any way, or will it all be handled through your office? Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, it's hard to tell without the situation in front of us. I think that the thing that we should keep in mind is we're talking about administering something that we would have to administer anyway. What the Pentagon is doing is they're requesting that the chief elections official be able to take action immediately. Otherwise, the Department of Defense will sue the state to take whatever action they feel is necessary. So it's not a question of whether or not we're going to have to take the action. The question is how quickly and whether or not we're going to have to pay court costs. And so it's actually less expensive to do it this way than to have to go to court and be ordered to do this.
Mr. Chair?
Representative,
I'm sorry, but this opens up an incredible... First, in the words of my colleague, Representative Simon, the answer is quite revealing. And second, I'm wondering if Ms. Frazier and her office have determined that now there are court costs that we've never heard about today, do I get, as a person that's involved in policymaking, do I get information to be able to balance the court costs or the chance of a lawsuit that Ms. Frazier has now thrown into the mix versus the cost that my counties may be in local authorities may have to absorb, in the word of Representative Kalin? I think we should.
Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Frazier, you suggest that it's hard to tell until the situation comes before us. So how are we, without the rules provision, then how are we to know exactly what's going to happen? I mean, and why is it that you're assuming that the current structure with the executive council, you're assuming that the council won't act? I'm not sure that assumption is correct. You're assuming that the only way to act in compliance with YoCAVA is for you, the Secretary of State's office, to act alone. A couple things. Why can't the council act together like they currently do? Why do we have to shift powers into one body? And then how do you substantiate to a policy-making body that we should just say, oh, okay, I know it's hard to tell,
But we don't need any guidelines. We don't need any parameters. We don't need any rules around it. How do we have confidence in what's actually going to occur as we hand over these powers?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, the Federal Voting Assistance Program works very closely with the states. And when there are situations like this, when it looks like the state is not going to be able to fulfill the requirements of the Uniformed and Overseas Citizen Absentee Voting Act, other states have been sued to ensure compliance with that act. Luckily, up until now, I don't believe that Minnesota has. And the Pentagon works with the state to figure out what the procedures are that need to be taken. I don't know what else I can say other than that.
Representative Olson.
Thank you. I'll be very brief. Ms. Frazier, on line 916, it identifies mobilization of those forces. I believe that's going on every year, and it has been for some years that we've had mobilization forces, because that does not specify that they are in conflict. On 918, it says unreasonable. Current law is described as unreasonable in the everyday, every year military situation overseas. I read this to mean that every year, for the past many years, the Secretary of State's office could have declared an emergency, used emergency orders. They don't declare an emergency by this language, but use emergency orders to prescribe different procedures. I think this language is very flawed. Could you comment on that highlighted point?
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olson, you are correct that that the current procedures are unreasonable, and that, but again, this provision would only be enacted if the entire bill is enacted, which would then, of course, alleviate the concerns and the unreasonableness of the current procedures, and therefore substantial compliance with UOCAVA would only occur in mass mobilization or other concerns, concerns you raised about the mobilization of guard units and so forth, which does happen. You know, we've sent small units to Kosovo and other places, and for their service we're incredibly grateful. The bill would cover both the civilian and the military parts of those units that are being sent overseas, and so the emergency powers provision would only be the substantial compliance being impossible or unreasonable beyond what is included in the bill. Again, it's very, very difficult to go sort of point by point in terms of what could happen in an emergency or in mass mobilization, but I do think that that the Pentagon does believe that, and I'm convinced that it is important to include the provision should something happen 2 days before an election and we need to send a battalion overseas.
Rep. Timble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really would like to hear comments from Ms. Frazier on behalf of the Secretary of State's office on this point.
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I guess I would just echo what Representative Kalin just said, that this is part of a package suggested by the Pentagon, and that if the entire bill were enacted, that we would be able to get ballots to those in the military and civilians overseas in a much more timely fashion. So this would only be necessary if troops or others were called up at the last minute.
Mr. Chair, I won't belabor...
Representative Olson, briefly...
I won't belabor the point, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to leave Ms. Frazier with this request, that if you have documentation of the Pentagon's request for this language, I'd like to see that.
All right, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, this line of questioning is as sensible as at the time of the construction of the 35W bridge 40 years ago, someone would have said, how are we going to deal with the emergency that might happen should the bridge fall down in 40 years from now? So,
all right, members, I think we've had a thorough discussion of the Olson Amendment to delete Section 15. All those in favor of the Olson Amendment to delete Section 15 signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Mr.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested on the bill. Representative Kalin renews his motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kalin renews his motion. Roll call has been requested. We are under
Mr.
roll.
Mr. Chairman, I move the table, Representative Kalin, so I'd like to discuss...
We are under language. Roll call, Representative Broad. The chair votes aye.
Anderson? Representative Anderson?
This is on the motion
to pass the bill.
Just for the motion to table, it's not a higher motion.
Represent, the motion before us was to pass the bill. We were under roll call at the time.
Mr. Chairman, I did have my hand up before that motion.
I'm sorry, we were under roll call at the time.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have not started roll call.
Mr. Chairman, I would join in the protest with Representative Broad and Representative Anderson.
Representative Broad, make your motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move to table Representative Kalin's bill on the basis that I'd like to work on some language with Representative Schulte to ensure enfranchisement for as many folks as possible.
So your motion is to table
the
bill. All right, all those in favor, roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. The chair votes no.
Anderson?
Aye.
Rod?
Yes.
Emmer?
Yes.
Okay.
No.
Howell? Khan?
No.
Take more than that.
Kalin?
No.
Morgan?
No.
Nelson?
No.
Olson?
Yes.
Peterson? Poppy?
No.
Simon?
No.
Winkler?
No.
Holzlager?
No.
There being four ayes and ten nays, the motion does not pass.
I'm reading my motion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kalin renews his motion as amended that
the
Senate file 1218 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. And a roll call has been requested. We are under roll. The chair votes aye.
Anderson?
No.
Rod?
No.
Emmer?
No.
Hilty?
Aye.
Khan?
Aye.
Representative Collins here. Kalin?
No.
Aye.
Morgan?
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
Olson?
No.
Peterson?
Aye.
Poppy?
Aye.
Simon?
Aye.
Winkler?
Aye.
Wolfslager?
Aye.
There being 11 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails. Members, we're going to stay just a little bit longer. I'm going to bring up House File 3367. House File 3367, the motion will be to recommend House File 3367 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Public Safety and Civil Law. There is an amendment. It is the DE1 amendment. I will move the DE1 amendment. And that will put the bill in order, so all those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And then if I could have the Mark Anthonson, and there were a couple of others, if they could come down quickly, very quickly, and speak to the bill. This is a bill that has been worked on the past month with the newspaper associations and with several other groups. And if you would speak to the bill as amended with the DE1 amendment. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members. Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. I will be very brief. I understand your time constraints. This bill amends the open meeting law, an important state statute that affirms the connection between a government by the people and the operations of its government. The law has been severely weakened the last several years for a variety of reasons. It doesn't function very well, mainly because there are no practical ways to enforce it. It really can't be enforced by average citizens because of the cost of attorney's fees, mainly. So this bill, as amended, as the amendment would propose, would do three things. It would require that all closed meetings be tape recorded, except for those arising under the attorney-client privilege. It would give the Commissioner administration somewhat broader authority to issue advisory opinions that could support an attorney's fees award if a judge ruled as the commissioner did. And thirdly, it would make attorney's fees somewhat easier to obtain. Wouldn't require them, but would give the court somewhat more discretion to award attorney's fees to a successful citizen who brought an enforcement action. These are relatively modest changes. Collectively, they will significantly strengthen the public's right to know. And I'll leave it there for now. All right. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Lori Barkopensky. I direct the from the Department of Administration, the Office of the Immigration Policy Analysis Division. I can't remember where I'm from. While we don't take a position on the bill, my office assists the commissioner in issuing advisory opinions on data practices and open meeting law, and this will make the strength of an open meeting law the same as the authority you've already given to data practices, so has the ability to hopefully promote the kind of compliance with the open meeting law that you would like to see.
All right. Thank you. And I believe we have one more individual to testify. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Will Rossbach. I am a current council member in the city of Maplewood, and my city has, over the last couple of years, had some issues where we struggled with the open meeting law, and I would recommend and support any changes that could be made to the open meeting law to give it more strength and the ability for it to be more easily enforced. I would also point out to the members of the committee that it is not necessarily in the situation of a fractured or dysfunctional council that this would apply the most. It probably applies the most when you have a council that gets along well with each other and they choose to go into a closed meeting situation and then stray off of their agenda that they have laid out for that just because they're comfortable with each other. In the situations where you have a council that is not working well together, then they do a very good job of making sure the other person is not doing anything wrong. And so I would certainly recommend that this is something that you consider and move forward.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great bill. I think the more openness, the better, and I thank all those who collaborated on it. But one thing, Mr. Chair, on line 2.4 of the DE amendment, I have in mind, I think, what would be a helpful amendment. But did I hear you to say, Mr. Chair, that this is going to be...
this is going to public safety and civil law.
Okay.
And mainly because of those sections.
I'm happy to make the amendment there in the interest of time. Thank you.
Any further, Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who to direct this question to, but I do have some concerns about the data that is collected and put on these tapes. If there is some kind of mechanism that we have in place, or perhaps is this language that you could include in the bill at some point. I'm just worried that you're going to have tapes floating out there for 3 years and how they're going to be stored and what kind of accountability measures we'll have in place to just make sure that that's protected, because when they do have closed meetings for legitimate reasons, a lot of times it's very sensitive information that is shared during those closed meetings. I just want to make sure that that information it doesn't fall in the wrong hands and that's properly secured.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, that's a very complex question because, as you know, government bodies covered by the open meeting law can talk about a fabulous and complex spectrum of information. And we thought a little bit about in doing this bill that we would try and address every possible category of data that might be discussed in a closed meeting. It's really an impossible task. I think a far more efficient solution, the one that the bill reflects, is we let the Data Practices Act, the record classification statute of the state, govern this tape. Public bodies collect all kinds of private data, and they do a very good job of protecting it from wrongful disclosure now. The tape would simply become one more type of such data, and it would be disclosed publicly only if the data on the tape somehow would be public under the Data Practices Act.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm more concerned about a lot of times it's personnel issues that are discussed in some of these closed meetings, and you know, so the next day this tape that's taken care of, you know, it's the people internally, not so much the public on the outside, but it's still a closed meeting, but this information is not falling into, you know, a fellow employee's hands who says, oh, do you know what they discussed last night, hee-hee-ha, type thing. So I'm just a little concerned about, you know, storage of it, and that's more my concern, not so much from the
Mr. Anderson, you want to respond?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anderson. Again, it's a very legitimate concern. I don't think there's a perfect solution to your anxiety, but there are extraordinarily severe penalties in the Data Practice Act, both civil damage and criminal, for wrongfully releasing private or confidential data. Historically, given all the private and confidential records government bodies in the state have and how exceedingly rare it is that they're wrongfully disclosed, I'd have a pretty high level of confidence that these tapes would be treated comparably.
Representative
Cox. Mr. Chairman, I have a question of grammar or language. On 1.9 and 1.10, as opposed to the previous bill, we have the phrase, not public data. Is that in English?
Kind of, you're working off the DE1 amendment?
Sorry. Yes.
The DE1
yes.
amendment.
Okay, yes. Right. Page 1.6. But that's not... Oh. Okay.
Representative Cox, the bill was significantly changed. It's been a long discussion for the last 4 weeks between the groups involved, and subsequently there's been an agreement on the DE1 amendment, and that's what's before us. Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 3367 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to public safety and civil law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes of Tuesday, March 11th.
Representative Morgan moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.